Saving money on your entire roofing project now at Menards. Protect your home for years to come with Owens Corning Architectural Shingles. They offer long-lasting performance while providing ultimate protection with a 130 miles per hour wind rating and limited lifetime warranty. Choose from over 50 options of Owens Corning shingles in-store and on Menards.com. And check out more of our great deals going on now. Save big money at
Menards. Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Podcast One presents the Steve Austin Show Classics.
I'm talking with Booker T, WWE Hall of Famer. Back in the day, many, many years ago, one of the top five workers in the world.
All time.
You remember when you pulled that rib way back in the day in WCW? And the whole locker room got all stirred up about it.
You know, especially Regal. Regal hated me, man, for doing that. Man, he wanted to fight me all the time for, doing that stupid deal. But, hey, man, you know what, though? I believed it. You know, I believed it back then, man. I had to make myself believe it, man, in that locker room. You know, it was a lot of top flight talent, man. You know, like yourself, like Jericho and, you know, so Eddie, so many others, man. And if I didn't do that, but more importantly, though, Steve, I went out and backed it up a lot of times, too, man. I went out and worked my ass off to be, you know, who I became.
We were talking the other day on the telephone, and, man, I've been wanting to do a podcast with you for years, but I always wanted to do it in person to talk about your career and everything like that. And I've told so many stories over the past, you know, during podcasts. I was talking to Dallas Page and the story when you was trying to knock me out. And, but we never have got to sit down in person to do a podcast. And I called you the other day and I said, oh, man, we just got to do one over Skype. And we started talking about MMA, and I didn't really know that you were a huge MMA fan. When did you first start watching?
I've been a fan since day one, man, since Horace Gracie. But the thing, though, when you called me, I caught you off guard. You know what I'm saying? This Booker T. This Booker T. I go back to the Horace Gracie days, man. You know, the Shamrock, the ultimate warriors, man, the gladiators of the sport, man. Those guys, you know, I've been intrigued a long time about it. I'm an advocate for those fighters, too, because, you know, those guys, they work their butts off, man. And, you know, the money they get paid, I'm pushing for more money for those guys, man, because they are true warriors. And at the end of the day, man, they need to be taken care of.
Hey, man, when you was coming up in the business of pro wrestling, I'm sure you've had a lot of guys ask you just because of your physicality, your look. You always spend a lot of time in the gym, but people always ask me, they say, hey, man, you love MMA. How do you think you would have fared if you got in it? If you would have got in it, how do you think you would have fared?
You know, I honestly don't know, man, because, we're going to be talking about, UFC later on. But, you know, in that game, it's about levels. You know, you could be great, you know, on the elementary school, schoolyard, and then you get to high school and them guys beat you up. You know what I mean? Those guys in high school, they thought they were tough, and then they go to college and then those guys get beat up. And then those guys in college, they go to the pros and they go, wow, I thought it looked slower than it actually really is. You know, so fighting is levels, man. And, it's something that you gotta embrace. You know, most of the time, you know, from when you're a little kid or from when you're at a young age, let's just say that.
Well, hey, man, when you first started in the business, you were trained by Scott Casey and who else?
I went to Ivan Putski School, but Scott Casey, he was the guy who put the blueprint in my head as far as what wrestling was all about, you know, as far as storytelling, you know, as far as Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, going out and,
creating and making the fans, you know, feel a certain way opposed to just watching it, you know. But so Scott Casey, he would put the blueprint.
Hey, man, and the thing about it was he was going through Dallas at the time, and I know you broke in 89, correct?
Yep.
And I broke in the back.
Actually, 90. You know, everybody always want to put me in 89 and make me a little older. You know, even on social media, they say I'm 55. You know, I'm 53. Let's get the record straight right here. Stone Cold Steve Austin with Booker T. I'm 53 years old, but look at this right here. Check this out right here at 53. Bam! You know what I mean? And I'm still looking good. So, but now I broke in 1990, man, and I got my break in 92 in WCW.
But what was the deal with Scott Casey training you? Because he was actually going to train me for a period of time. I was going to work at Watkins Motor Lines when I was working on a freight dock. And then, man, I happened upon Scott Casey, and we started talking. I wanted to get into the business, but then I guess he went off to Houston. And so all of a sudden, Scott Casey was no longer going to train me because I didn't know where he went. So that's when I hooked up with gentleman Chris Adams, because I saw his wrestling school commercial on TV. And I went down there, and it all worked out for me because, you know, he put me in a high-profile angle because he was trying to push his school. You know, after five months in the business, you know, I went down to Tennessee, worked for a little bit, and Jerry Jarrett sent me back, and that's when I turned heel and started working with Chris. And the only reason I was able to win Rookie of the Year in 90 was because I was in a high-profile angle with gentleman Chris Adams. And my training back in the day, dude, we did the basic shit. We learned how to do some tumbling drills. We learned how to take bumps. And we did that over and over again. And there was 25 or 30 of us in a class. We had one ring, and we worked out one day a week. And that was after the television taping. So, Chris didn't even smarten me up after 5 months before my first match, going into the Dallas Sportatorium to work with the world-famous Frogman LeBlanc. And right then, right before motherfucking television taping, that's when I found out the business is a work. Now, I knew something was up, but he wasn't going to smart me up for nothing. Dude, right before I went out there, we laid out a little bullshit match, and referee Tony Falk, who's good as gold, was trying to call me spots out there, and we stunk out the joint, as we always do when we was green. But my question to you...
You don't know that.
Oh, yeah. But what did your training consist of with Scott Casey and Ivan Putski? Because Putski was more of a showman. He was a strong man.
I can tell you, let me tell you what happened to Scott first. When he left and went to Texas, Ivan Putski opened a wrestling school, man. And, it was like one of the most high profile wrestling schools you would ever, you know, want to walk into at that time, man. I mean, it was plush. It was in the southwest side of town, you know. We had, you know, one wrestling ring on one side. On the other side, we had full wrestling mats, you know. We had televisions and video cameras, you know, watching us and stuff like that. Ivan Putski had a, slipped on a banana peel, man, and got some sponsors, man, and they were all behind this thing. And he hired Scott, man, and paid Scott some good money to come up and help him, get the training done. And that's how I got hooked up with Scott. Scott, you know, as far as what consisted of our training, you know, I got lucky. Ivan Putski, he was a gimmick guy. He really wasn't a wrestler. You know, he never went out and actually had a wrestling match, I don't think, in his whole career. He's been in a lot of, you know, matches, but, you know, as far as the wrestling go, that's another story. So we didn't do a lot of burpees, a lot of, you know, Hindu squats and stuff like that. But we did learn psychology from Scott Casey. And Scott Casey taught me, like I say, the small little bitty things such as taking a headbutt in the turnbuckle, you know what I mean? How to sell, you know, a tackle properly, you know what I mean? How to, you know, create some spaces and a little bitty stuff like that, you know. So the school only lasted about 6 months, and it was closed down. So all the money that he was spending bringing talent in, stuff like that. But I got lucky. I was in on the first crop.
How long did it take you to really understand the art of selling? Because when I got in the business, man, at first, for those first 2 months, PY, Chu High, all of the big, bad, tough-ass heels were coming down into Dallas. And for the first 2 months, dude, I got my ass whipped with kendo sticks, weightlifting belts. I was this white meat baby face with long blonde hair because I just got finished playing football at North Texas State University. So they knew that I was a student of Chris Adams. So I wasn't having matches. I was just a whipping boy. And they was going out there and beating the flying puff out of me. And then finally I started getting in the ring and, you know, shit, you can go back and watch, one of my matches with the Undertaker. And I guess he was working as a Punisher back in the day. And I wasn't worth the flying fuck. And because I came out of a football background, I kind of considered myself, you know, not a tough guy as far as walking around and fighting people on the streets, but I was a pretty big motherfucker. So I'm thinking, you know, all of a sudden, you know, when I'm out there working with superstar Bill Dundee, who is one of my favorites and taught me a shitload about the business and psychology and really took care of me. Holy shit, man. Bill was 5'7", about 200 pounds. And Bill never worked like a small guy. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I'm thinking, man, I got to sell for this guy. And it was my conversation with Tojo Yamamoto. Did you ever know Tojo?
Nah, I've never met Tojo.
Well, man, one time, you know, he's telling me, he's trying to smarten me up about selling, you know, so I could get some sympathy. Because, dude, if you and me are working, as we have many times, if I'm doing something to you, man, you ain't selling it, and you're doing something to me and I ain't selling it, nothing means shit because nothing hurts. So Tojo said, grab my ear. And I grabbed his earlobe. And, man, he cringed, booger, like I just ripped his ear off. And he looks at me and he goes, that sell. And that's when the light bulb went off in my head. How long did it take you to put the nuances and the art and the performance all into it? Because I know you was always a good athlete.
I took to wrestling really, really quick, man. For some reason, it seemed like it was something I was meant to do. It was like deja vu. You know, but, you know, selling, for me, I talk to my students about it all the time. You know, it's acting and reacting. That's pretty much all it is, you know. And I got into a lot of fights when I was a kid, man. I used to kick a lot of ass, man, and beat up a lot of guys around the neighborhood. But I remember this one kid down the street, man, and, you know, he called me out to a fight. And, you know, the fight was actually in my yard. And I remember what that ass kicking feel like, man, because that guy beat me up so bad, man. He beat me up so bad. But then on top of that, I got a chance to, you know, sit under the learning tree of guys like Manny Fernandez, you know, guys like, you know, Jim Mantell, you know, guys like Black Bart, you know, John Tatum. You know, Maniac Mike Davis, you know, those names, man, those guys were stars, man, you know, in Dallas. And they were true bona fide wrestlers. You know, when I see Stone Cold Steve Austin, I see gorgeous Gary Young running around, you know, in my head every single time, because those guys, you know, they were truly, truly great, you know, athletes and great stars and entertainers down there in Dallas. And I learned so much, man, you know, riding, you know, and actually driving, and Black Bart sitting in the back seat, you know, telling me which way to go there. You know? So that's how I learned, dog.
Dude, I remember sitting around some of the hotel rooms because I was traveling for a brief period of time with Black Bart and a little bit of Nikita Koloff. And you know Black Bart, he'd always had his glasses, and he'd push his glasses up and he'd be spitting in his little spit cup and dropping knowledge. And, you know, to your point, man, I was riding up and down the road with Skandar Akbar and Bronco Lubitsch. I mean, I had no ride. I didn't have no friends. You know, I wasn't over. So I was riding with them. They took me under their wings. And then I hooked up with gorgeous Gary Young. And we was riding down the road in his 280ZX. And I'm asking him questions the whole time. Billy Joe Travis, Jimmy Jack Funk, Maniac Matt Bourne. You know, a lot of those guys, I mean, those are ace workers. Never got really big runs, but outstanding teachers and outstanding workers in their own right.
Hall of Fame talent right there you just named. I mean, on both sides, all those guys, Hall of Fame talent, man. And that's what, you know, we talk about, you know, the young guys now that's out there doing their thing. Those guys, it's a lot of great talent, you know, on the roster today. These young guys, they can do things, you know, unimaginable to guys like us when we were doing it. But they didn't get a chance to actually learn, you know, what it was like to – you know, peek through the curtain and watch the crowd reactions when certain guys are out there, you know, taking it to another level. And then take that knowledge yourself and put it in your playbook and in your black bag and say, man, I'm going to use this somewhere down the line. They didn't get a chance to get that worldly experience. And I think that's the difference between us and them, as far as, you know, going out and performing.
You know, I thought that the guys like you and me, you had a few more moves than me, a little bit more athletic than me, but we didn't do anything crazy. I mean, the athleticism that's going on in the squared circle these days is off the charts. I mean, don't get me wrong. You can go back and you had your Dynamite Kids and stuff like that. Those, but they were kind of rare individuals. The way the business has sped up now, and I'm a big fan of the business, and especially when the guys are having good matches and telling great stories, and the same with the women. But what do you think about just stylistically how the business has transitioned into as athletic as it is now? Because it was not this way by and large, except for a few rare exceptions, with regards to style in the ring.
Well, you know, I can sum it up. You know, it's really, really simple. You know, I like you say, I love what these guys are doing right now. These guys are unbelievable athletes. But the chant nowadays is, you know, this is awesome. This is awesome. You know, and I love that chant. You know what I mean? That's the chant that I want the whole arena, you know, saying, you know, by the end of the night. But I want them to be saying it at the end of the night, not in my match, you know, because I need them, you know, like when I was wrestling Stone Cold Steve Austin and I'm a heel, I need those fans chanting Stone Cold. And then I need them to get me going. Not this is awesome for me just to go ahead and jump on something and break something. I need an investment. I need an emotional connection. And that's the difference between what we did and what the young guys do now. And some of them do it as of late. I can honestly say, you know, Seth Rollins, man, I mean, this guy, he has been doing some his storytelling, man. I mean, it's like writing a great romance novel. That's how good Seth Rollins has gotten as of the last, you know, 6 months to a year. And I hope all of those guys, you know, can fall into that same mode, because he's thinking about his body now because he's getting a little bit older. And I think that's one of the things. These guys are young and they don't realize until they get a little bit older.
But as far as the showmanship goes, and because you can be a great worker, because we've all known great workers who never got to the highest level that they should have gotten it. And I bring a classic point right now, Brad Armstrong. Brad Armstrong was one of the best workers, if not the best worker, in the locker room, and he was universally respected. He could work American style, Japanese style, lucha style. It didn't matter. Brad could work his ass off. And as good as he was, he never got to that next level. And if he could turn it on, like, you know, when that red light on that camera was on, like he couldn't in the locker room, man, he'd have been the biggest star in the territory. But my point in telling you that story was, you were a great athlete, and I guess you were born with a charisma, but also your showmanship. And if I'm not mistaken, I believe you told me a story one time about you being a huge Bruce Lee fan. And,
oh, man.
And like Bruce Lee was instrumental, because, dude, some of the stuff which you would do, the after effect was exactly what, like a Bruce Lee, if you just think, okay, he goes over and chops a bunch of stuff up and that he's just going through the motions and it's cool. You can respect the ability, but dude, when he stomped a motherfucker and all of a sudden he's doing that face and he's making all those sounds. Tell me and tell everybody about how big of an influence, man, Bruce Lee was on you.
I tell people all the time, man, you're never going to watch a karate movie without hearing somebody yell. There's always going to be some of that. If that's not in the movie, it's not a great karate movie. I don't care if it's a Chuck Norris, you know, karate movie. I was just watching, you know, the Five Fingers of Death and the Five Deadly Venoms just last night. And the thing is, I've watched these movies 100 times, maybe 1,000 times a piece. But the thing is, you know, that's where I got my entertainment from. You know, the boss, you know, every karate boss, you know, he was badass. You couldn't just walk up on him. You know, you thought you could. You wondered how he became the boss. It was because he could kick everybody's ass. You know, so those stories, man, you know, my scissor kick, you know, coming from the best of the best, you know, the movie with Eric Roberts, you know, back in the day, you know, stuff like that, man. I was, you know, drawn in. My sidekick, I always wanted to fly like a ninja. You know, ninjas could fly, you know what I mean? And that sidekick, you know, I would tell my brother, hold him up as high as you can, you know what I mean? And I'm going to go up there and get him, you know what I mean? And I would do it, you know, effortless, you know, sometime. And that's what wrestling is, man. It's the embodiment of going out and making the fans feel like, man, when you put that suit on, you are truly like Superman, man. When you went out there and stomped a mud hole in a man and walked it dry, you actually believed it when you, and some of those boots were pretty stiff.
Hey, man, before we segue into a little bit of UFC 228, you got to tell a story about the time, because I've told it on the podcast before. I want to hear your take on it, because it was you and me in the ring together, and we always enjoyed working together. We knew each other since when you came into WCW. Hell, I guess I was there first. And then you guys came in, you and Stevie Ray, but we enjoyed working with each other. But one time we was working, it was WWE or WWF back in the day. And man, we had just started working.
Yep, yep.
And man, you knocked the dog shit out of me. And I was always real patient with sending receipts, because, you know, I was just like, okay, dude's off. And I like to work snug anyway. But man, you hit me so damn hard. I said, no, man. I said, I got to send back a receipt now. So what happened that night? You tell a story. I've told it too many times.
The way I remember that story is we got one more we got to talk about, too, as far as when I first got in the WWF. We got to talk about that story. But, you know, what I remember about the night that I whacked you, you know, I'm known to, you know, be snug. I'm known to be a little, you know, I wouldn't say stiff or anything, but, you know, I'm one of those, I'm old school. If you hit a guy in the lip and you bust his lip, you know, that's just part of, you know, part of the business. But normally that's in the exchange. That's normally when you guys are going at it, not when things just get started, you know, but I don't know, maybe I was wound up. But I do remember hitting you and blood came out of your lip. And I go, oh, shit. I ain't mean to do that. That's what I'm saying in my mind, you know. But in my mind as well, I'm knowing that I'm going to get a receipt back, you know, somewhere in this match. And the thing is, what I remember that night, you was really, really passive as far as getting that receipt back. But the receipt I remember getting back was a stomp right to the face when I was laying down on the ground. And it was a stiff shot right to the nose. And the thing is, I felt like I deserved that. You know what I mean? It didn't bust me up or anything, but it was a stiff shot. And it was purposely done. Now, in business, a man could only respect that. You know what I mean? That's the way I remember that going. And that, should I have been, you know, in the back, you know, waiting on you behind the curtain before that stiff shot? No, because I delivered the stiff shot first, and the receipt was there given. So I understand that. I totally understand that, you know. But young guys need to understand that when you're out there performing, that this is not, you know, a day in the park, man. It's, you know, it's about, especially when you're on TV. You got to go out there and lay those shots in. You got to go out there and whack that guy. Sometimes it do get a little, testy, you know, and guys want to, you know, get a little rowdy with each other. And I always said, hey, that's good for TV. Go out there and let all of that hang out. If I need to bring you back, I'll bring you back. And I think that's something you and I both brought to the table.
It's funny because the business of pro wrestling is such a work. A lot of people tell you, you were there. I think you were there when Sean, maybe it's before you came in, when Sean and Brett were kind of working an angle, and there was a lot of heat between those guys. And yeah. I think they was fixing to do that 60-minute Broadway or whatever it was, Iron Man match. But all of a sudden people think, oh, man, these two guys are mad at each other. It's going to be a hell of a match. Dude, when two people are really mad at each other and they shoot heat, normally the match ain't that good because both guys don't want to really cooperate with each other. It's got to be a total work in there, and sometimes things can go bad. Sometimes you can get a shot or a receipt or stuff like that, but, man, you got to maintain your composure because, like you said, it is what it is. It's very physical. It ain't ballet. You're always trying to protect the business, even though the business is a known work. But when two guys in there and they're really mad at each other, it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a great match.
You know, being really mad at each other is one thing, but do you agree with me or not? Every time I had to go out and perform at a very high level with a guy, you know, no matter whether he was my best friend or not, when I walked out of that curtain, I really wanted to whoop his ass. From an entertaining perspective, but I really wanted to go out and whoop his ass, and the camera needed to see that in order to be able to understand what was getting ready to happen. I don't know. A lot of times I could see when guys getting ready to go out and have a match, when getting ready to go out and perform and play wrestler, you know, and for me, coming out of the curtain, that moment in time was frozen because I really believed in what I was getting ready to go out there and do.
Dude, I agree with you 100%. When I was out there, it didn't matter whether it was promo, whether it was a match, or this was the interesting thing, and I don't know how long it took for you to really find yourself as a character and a character that you totally believed in. It took me a while because I remember, you know, in USWA and even in World Championship Wrestling in Atlanta, I was Steve Austin. I was Stunning Steve Austin, but I didn't really know what that meant. All of a sudden, when I kind of started getting up, I come up with that Stone Cold idea, and I turned into Stone Cold, and I started growing into that character, and I was the BMF, and I believed that I could beat anybody's ass. I believed it was 120% shoot. Now, I was working, but I believed it, and that, for me, because I remember one time we was riding down the road. Primetime Brian Lee was in the back. I was driving. Tom Pritchard was riding shotgun, and he said, "Steve," he goes, "what's so stunning about Stunning Steve?" And I didn't have an answer for him. And he said, "Primetime." He goes, "what's so primetime about Brian Lee?" He didn't have an answer. But as Stone Cold, I had that answer. And the comfort to perform within that character, I was way better in that ring when I was Stone Cold than trying to be something else. Because my mindset, my belief system was so... That's all that existed. It was a total shoot for me. How long did it take you to come up with that same type of presentation or mindset?
Hey, man, I'm going to tell you, man, those karate movies that I watched from when I was a kid, man, I always had that one mindset because of the boss, you know, and all of those karate movies, you know, that I watched, the boss was, you know, he was badass, you know, and every time someone tested the boss, he showed how real he had to be with those guys. You know, all those, you know, Shaft movies I watched, you know what I mean? Richard Roundtree was badass, man. Yeah. You know what I mean? He didn't take no shit off nobody. And I wanted to be like Shaft, you know, I mean, that's what Can You Dig It, Sucker came from, you know, me watching those movies. And just for me, I always knew my role. When I remember Big Van Vader, God rest his soul, you know, my first pay-per-view in WCW, you know, my first pay-per-view, I'm in the main event, and Big Van Vader, he asked me, "Hey, man, you think you really ready for this?" You know, and he was shooting. He was really shooting because I was green. And I go, "Hell yeah, I'm ready for this, man. I've been training for this. This is a moment that I've been relishing for a long time." But I knew what my job was that night, was to go out there and bump for all of those old guys. Make them look good. Make them shine like new money. And then when I get in the back, they're going to say, "Kid, you did a good job." You know what I mean? So I was trained to know what the test was in order to go out there and pass the test, even, you know, when I first got into WCW.
Well, from watching the movies that you watched, and we're going to get to some MMA in just a second, but watching the movies that you're watching, working with Scott Casey and Ivan Putski, who was a showman, like, who stressed to you that you need to be strong as a character, not just a worker going through the motions, that character? Because I believe that going through the motions is one thing, but when you have that all-encompassing character that people can buy into, when you combine all those things, I think that's when you draw money and you sell tickets.
You know, Steve, I think that's the reason why I'm still here today. I think that's why I'm still, you know, relevant, you know, because, you know, I think as yourself, you know, it's never really been about me along this journey. I mean, of course, you know, I've been reaping the benefits of it, but it's always been about getting the script. You know, I mean, how many characters have you been, you know, and every time you got the script, you went out there and tried to make it the best you possibly could, you know, and when Stone Cold Steve Austin came, that's the one that stuck, of course, but all the time getting to that point, you made it the best you possibly could along the way. So for me, getting the role, man, and taking that role and enhancing that role and making it, you know, what I wanted it to be, no matter what it was. It was G.I. Bro. You know what I mean? I was G.I. Bro back in the day. And Dallas Page, he told a story, you know, I was listening to him. And he goes, you know, he came by and he saw me in the mirror and he goes, man, what are you doing? I used to work for a living, man. You know what I mean? I used to have nothing. And now I'm doing something, I'm having fun. So, my brother told me, my brother Stevie, he said, man, I'm going to help you get a job. He said, the only thing I'm asking you to do, man, is, you know, don't make me look bad, man. He said, man, just do the job to the best of your ability. I don't care if it's sweeping floors. I don't care if it's washing windows. He said, man, just do the job to the best of your ability to what next comes along. And he said, you can do that, man. I'm going to help you. That's what he told me when I came home from prison. And I believe in that to this day, man. Every script that I've gotten, you know, I just went out and did the job. Becoming the world champion, that's not something that I went home and dreamed about or anything. I just wanted to go out and be the best guy on the card each and every night, whether I was or not, you know, whether I was top five, you know, in the business or not, you know what I mean? You know, I was going to try to make it, you know, look that way off. I was going to try to feel that way each and every time I went out and performed, no matter what the role was, man. Every time they gave me something, you know, Booker T and Goldust, I want to go out there and make it the best that it was and entertain the fans to the utmost that I possibly could.
Hey, man, shifting gears a little bit to the UFC talk. We were going to talk about 228 and maybe the preliminary matches, if you saw those as well. But the UFC started in, give or take, right around 1993. And I remember when it first came out because, you know, way back in the day, you and me are the exact same age. Man, you see tough man contests on TV, and it was usually a couple of drunk guys with beer bellies, and they'd come out just swinging like this, and in 40 seconds, both of them was gassed, just totally blown up, and it was a shits. But that was what was going on back in the day. Then all of a sudden, UFC comes along, and it's all these different styles, and so if you're, a striker could be put up with a plain wrestler, and it was a lot of things are so one-sided or lopsided and just puffed up. It was like, I don't know, it was weird. And then all of these changes, when did you start watching? And what do you think about as dude, the stuff we saw in 228, there were some awesome matches, especially on the prelim card.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think about the evolution of MMA, specifically UFC?
I mean, definitely the godfather, Horace Gracie, you know, he put, you know, mixed martial arts as far as, you know, the sport on the map, as far as I'm concerned, as far as a small guy, if you go back and watch Horace Gracie, you know, the evolution of, you know, him taking the sport, you know, global, you know, because a guy so small, you know, going out, tapping guys out, you know, some of the guys that, you know, Gracie tapped out were heavyweights. Some of the guys Gracie tapped out were super heavyweights. A lot of people don't even remember that. People like, you know, Dan the Beast Severn, guys like Kimo, and his, you know, theatrics, you know, his pageantry, you know, coming to the ring back in the day, you know, Tito Ortiz, of course, you know, and his American flag, you know, and his flames, you know, coming to the ring, you know, of course, you know, Chuck Liddell, you know, who's, you know, now, you know, talking about, you know, him and Tito talking about getting back in the ring and doing it one more time with Golden Boy, you know, so to watch the evolution of the sport from there to now, it's been awesome. You know, we've seen a lot of great guys come through the sport. You know, we've seen more importantly, we've seen, you know, and we've been only watching it for, you know, last 20 years. But we've seen so many guys' careers start and so many careers finish in the UFC as well.
man, as I was watching this card, there was a couple of names on here that I had never heard of before. What do you think about the star-making business of the UFC or MMA? Because you're talking about a shoot sport, but in wrestling, you're trying to build characters that are going to draw money. In the fight game, just because you're a great fighter doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be a big draw at the box office. What are your thoughts on the star-making process as far as, you know, a shoot sport like MMA? What does it take to sell tickets?
I mean, one thing about MMA, they're going to continue to sell tickets. You know, people are going to continue to come and watch, you know, fight. You know, people are just intrigued, especially women. Women love to watch guys go out and just beat each other up for some reason. It's a sexual thing. I don't know what it is. But they love it, you know. So the fight game is going to be around for a long time. But the sport definitely have to evolve as far as trying to take care of the fighter. You know, I look at a guy like Deontay Wilder, who, you know, the boxer, the heavyweight champion of the world. You know, I mean, this guy, you know, he's been heavyweight champion for quite some time, and, you know, he's made a lot of money, you know, so when he retire, he's going to be, you know, hopefully, you know, if he, you know, manages money properly, you know, he's going to be okay. You know, with these UFC fighters, one thing I do not agree with, you know, like you say, the star power will never happen when you have, you know, the champion, you know, have to fight the number one contender every time they go out and fight. Now, I just don't believe in that. You know, me as the champion, I need a promoter like, you know, like Mickey, you know, with Rocky Balboa. You know, you remember when Mix told Rocky, you know, those guys was has-beens, you know what I mean? But, you know, they just wasn't killers like this guy, you know what I mean? This guy will eat you alive, Rock, you know what I mean? Talking about Mr. T, you know what I mean? So I need a guy like Mick, you know, covering for me, you know, so I can have a longer career and make more money and become more of a star. So when I leave this, you know, I might could get in an Expendables 3 or 5 or 10 or something like that.
Hey man, did you get a chance to, I'm not a Fight Pass guy, so I didn't see the matches. It was, or the fights that was on Fight Pass, but I saw, you know, the prelims. And most of the time, man, I don't watch the preliminaries. I just watch, you know, the pay-per-view and that's it. And I just got finished driving home, to LA from Nevada. And man, I was tired. And I said, man, I got to watch all these fights because me and Book are going to talk about them on the podcast. And so, man, I started watching the prelims and I was almost like kind of like dozing off a little bit. And then all of a sudden I got wrapped up in the stories. You know, I guess it was, Charles Byrd. I guess his hometown kid there in Dallas fighting against Darren Stewart. And the Stewart. British guy, known as being heavy-handed, and all of a sudden, you know, Charles Byrd, man, kind of handling him a little bit in that first round, and all of a sudden, dude, they go to round two, and then Darren Stewart starts doing what he does best. Kapow! Did you enjoy that fight? That fight, to me, that fight set the tone, because then that's, okay, I'm in for the prelims now.
That's the thing right there, you know what I mean? These guys don't have star power, so you don't know what you're going to see until you see it. You know what I mean? You don't know what kind of fighter you're going to see until you actually see him fight. You know, and then you watch a young guy like that who go out there and get a spectacular victory against a guy like that, and it looks great, you know. But there again, Steve, that's what a level of fighters, you know, that's what a level of fight game, you know, comes into play. When he goes out and fights someone a little bit on a higher level, he's going to have a little bit of trouble. You know what I mean? Watching his defense, watching, you know, certain little holes in this game. I mean, I looked at Aljamain Sterling. You know what I mean? Aljamain Sterling, he went out there and he got a big win. You know, but I still saw so many holes in this game, man. I saw so many little bitty things where, you know, if he was fighting a better fighter, you know what I mean, he could have easily gotten beat. But, you know, he pulled it off in spectacular fashion. I tell you, that guy's knee probably is going to be screwed up for the rest of his career. His career is probably over, you know, and from certain aspects, just from that one fight right there, you know. So, and the thing is, Aljamain Sterling, he's come a long way. He's a guy that they've been pushing to become a star, and he's still not that guy of, you know, pretty much what I would say star quality, you know, that got star power that's going to go out there and sell, you know, a building or arena or anything like that.
But, dude, man, he was throwing bombs. I mean, striking was impeccable. And all of a sudden, you know, the finish was fantastic. You didn't see this in this event because, most of the fights, there was a lot of action. But it's funny because coming from the world we come from in pro wrestling, man, you know, you try to get that crowd hooked. And then you're doing something through your storytelling, you know, all the packages that have been run as far as your angle, and you're taking in people on a ride. And so you want them to come up and down with you and get behind that baby face and to dislike the heel. What are your thoughts as far as just an MMA crowd, where a lot of times you will have two world-class fighters out there, but because their styles are kind of canceling each other out, seemingly it's a quote-unquote boring fight when you're actually seeing a masterpiece of a chess game, and they start booing and shit like that. What do you think about the MMA crowd? Why are they so fickle? You know,
Well, the crowd is only, you know, doing what they're supposed to do. You know, when I think, you know, when you got a referee, you know, MMA is the only sport in the history of sports where the referee can actually tell the fighter, "Come on, guys, we need more action."
Yeah.
Come on, guys. We gotta get it. Come on, guys. Come on. Chop, chop. You know what I mean? It's amazing, you know, when I see something like that happen, you know, and the thing is, you know, you do watch a guy go out there and he's technical, you know, and that's the way he fights for, because he's a prize fighter. He's not a guy that just want to go out there and get knocked out. I don't agree with, you know, these guys going out there just being looked at as cock fighters, you know, thrown in the chicken coop and say, "Hey, just fight." You know, that's not what, you know, I think it should be about. I don't think that's what they should be. Of course, there's a lot of them, you know, you look at Chris Lieben, you know, he's a, you know, former UFC Octagon warrior, guy who's gone out there and, you know, was willing to just walk in the shots, willing to just take them, you know, and I can almost guarantee you now, if you go and talk to Chris Lieben, if he's conscious, if he's coherent, he would tell you he would not do that ever again. You know, he would not walk into those shots that he took from Anderson Silva, you know, thinking that this was a game, thinking that this was something that was funny, when you could get brain damage. So I applaud those guys, you know, at the top level that say, "Hey, man, I'm not just going to go out there and just walk into anything just because the fans want me to go out there and do it." They did that to Floyd Mayweather. You know, Floyd Mayweather was the guy who got booed out of the building in many, many fights, you know, but who's the guy at the end of the day on top, you know, looking down?
Hey, man, you just talked about Chris Lieben, and I was a big fan of his back in the day. And, you know, he had, you know, a lot of problems with some drugs and painkillers and stuff like that. I don't know his whole story, and had a tough background, a very tough background. But when you start talking about stuff like that, as far as what it takes to be a top-level UFC fighter, even on their roster, the amount of toughness, the way those guys train every single day and the fights they put themselves through, people always say, "Hey, man, what's tougher, pro wrestling or MMA?" Because when you tell our schedule to some of those MMA guys who actually get what we do, they're like, "Man, what you guys do is crazy. I don't know if I could do that." So to me, it's a different level of toughness. Like the boys are like cockroaches. You know, we're in a different town every single night. We're at a different gym. We're on the road. We're eating at different restaurants. Just as far as toughness or a hard way of life, which one do you figure is a tougher?
You know, that's a tough question, man. That's a really tough question. What's tougher? You know, MMA, you know, professional wrestling. In professional wrestling, we definitely got to be physically tough. You know, that's something that we, you can't be a professional wrestler without being tough. You know, that just comes along with the territory, putting your body through something that's not meant for the human body to actually go through on a regular basis anyway. Sometimes, you know, 275 days plus, you know, doing it. That's just not something a human body, you know, is supposed to do. You know, baseball, they're, you know, they play 80 games, you know, I mean, 120 games a year, you know what I mean? That, you know, we put our bodies through a lot. But I think with professional wrestling, you know, our mental, you know, stress, you know, comes into play more than anything, you know, having to, you know, fly to Germany, you know, and, you know, get off the plane and go straight to the arena and perform and then go straight from the arena sometimes to go back to the plane to get on a, you know, the land, you know, in another country, you know, and go to the hotel for a couple hours, then go to the ring. You got a double shot that day. You know what I mean? Stuff like that. You know what I mean? The mental aspect comes into play. How far can you push yourself? You know what I mean? How long can you stay focused? You know, and for how many years? You know, for me, it's been almost 28 now, you know, so, That's the difference between what we do in MMA. Now, going out and getting kicked in the face with a shin, you know, getting elbowed and sliced open, you know what I mean? Getting, you know, my brains were getting choked out for a few seconds where there's no oxygen going to my brain. You know, there's a toll, and there's a there's something to be said about guys that, you know, that's willing to put themselves through that, you know. But as far as toughness go, it's just a difference.
I think it is a difference too, but I also think, man, with the wrestling business or pro wrestling as you and I know it, man, I always tell people you're kind of living three lives in one body. On one hand, you are a professional athlete because of the prep you do and what you're doing in the ring at a high level. Then on top of that, you can be a rock star. And when you go places, a lot of people will have things that you might want, and they're going to want to hang out with you. So then you turn into the rock star aspect along with the professional athlete. And then all on top of that, you're a truck driver because you're going to fly some places, but then you're going to get in a car and you're going to hump it down the road. So, I mean, it truly is that. And I was kind of known, you know, way back in the day, I ran with the crowd that I ran with. But when I finally started making some money, I started traveling by myself. But I was always with the drinking crowd. And, man, I mean, when I say I was with the drinking crowd, I mean, I was the drinking crowd and I always had my whiskey, whether it's whiskey, beer, stuff like that. So to me, to be on time every time, work hard, live that lifestyle, be the truck driver, you know, I feel pretty good after I did it all. But if I could go back and do it again, I would have taken a lot better care of myself and I would have slowed the partying down. And that being said, I don't think that a UFC fighter could live the lifestyle that I was living or Ric Flair was living, a whole different level because he's the greatest in my opinion. But doing the same kind of outlandish things, it takes a hell of a goddamn toll on your body, brother.
Well, it does, you know what I mean? But you look at these UFC fighters too, you know, that the lifespan of their careers are, you know, at the top level is about 3 years, man. That's it. These guys burnt out after 3 years. I look at a lot of these UFC fighters now, man, you know, and they look like old men. And they were, you know, Octagon Warriors 10 years ago, and you see them now, you go, wow, you know, Gabriel Gonzaga, what happened to him? You know, just because of, you know, I can only imagine what those guys feel like in the morning, not just from the fight, not just the fighting portion of it, but the training, you know, going in there and beating that dummy up all day, going in there running drills and whatnot, putting your body through stuff. You know, I look at guys, you know, like Ronnie Coleman right now, you know, great, you know, the greatest, one of the greatest bodybuilders of all time, if not the greatest, you know, and the guy, you know, he's in a wheelchair now because the way he pushed his body going out there lifting, you know, squatting, you know, 800 pounds, you know, repping, you know, behind the neck press 500 pounds, you know, stressing his body out so much. You know what I mean? So that stress and toll that these UFC fighters put on themselves to go out there and fight for that one night, you know, it's a guy by the name of Roger Huerta. He was on the cover of ESPN magazine for the UFC back in the day. You probably don't even remember him now, but Roger Huerta, he's right now, he's still fighting, but his fight level and skills dropped off like that because there's no way that you can continue to push your body to go out and stay up to fight every single time to fight the number one contender. Look at Tyron Woodley. They this is a guy, you know, UFC welterweight champion, a guy who's done nothing but win in the UFC. But there again, he's a guy that's not that willing to go out there and say, hey, I'm not going to just fight when you tell me to fight. I'm not going to just go out there and fight who you want me to fight. You know what I mean? Just because, you know what I mean? He pretty much, you know, calls his own shots. They don't like that. That's one of the reasons why they threw this kid, this Englishman, Darren Till in there, this kid who, you know, actually was not even a welterweight. You know, they put Darren Till in there to say, let's get the strap off this guy. We got to get the title off of him. You know what I mean? But Tyron Woodley, he's consistent. He does nothing but one thing. He goes out there and performs each and every night. That's because he takes care of himself. He's not one of those guys.
Hey, man, while you're talking about the brutality of some of the shots these people are taking, man, Carla Esparza, former champion, man, she gets in there with Diana Suarez, who overcame thyroid cancer way back in the day. And, dude, just go ahead and expand upon what your thoughts on that fight.
Well, Nama Yunez should have been watching.
You know what I mean? Rose should have been watching very, very close because the girl, she's big, she's long. I mean, she may call Esparza look like a little bitty girl in there. I mean, she just rat-tagged her. She just beat her all over the place. They should have stopped that fight, you know, just because it was a mismatch. You know, Carla Esparza, she's good, but she's got beat up, you know, a couple of times there, and it's just been a... It's just been about the level of fighter that she's going out there with. She's been getting overpowered just because she is. What? She's 5 foot tall. She's a small girl, and she's relying on her quickness to go out there and be able to, you know, fight a wrestler like Suarez. And Suarez, she did her job. She did her job, and she did it in fantastic fashion. Just a straight up beatdown.
Well, man, I got to give a real big shout out to Carla Esparza. I mean, because man, you talk about a damn throttling. I mean, Tatiana Suarez was all over her, just kept taking her down, kept taking her down, and all of a sudden there was one little hope spot when Carla gets up. And then all of a sudden, after that little hope spot, as we call it in pro wrestling, man, she backed down, and Suarez was just coming with those, that grounding pad and those vicious elbows, man. Suarez's head was just, I mean, dude, she was knotted up. It was brutal.
Yeah, yeah. And people compare, you know, MMA to boxing, you know, which is the most dangerous sport? Which one you take the most beating in, you know? And, you know, you look at that, you look at Carla Esparza's face, you know, after a fight like that. And in boxing, that fight would have been stopped because of the brutality of it. And MMA, the brutality, there is no stopping point until the guy is unconscious or dead, you know, in certain cases, you know, so it's definitely a brutal sport. And to see a woman like that, man, going out there, every time I see a woman get kicked to the ribs, man, all I think about is eggs cracking.
In the business of pro wrestling, you know, book, Jesus Christ.
You're listening to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
Steve Austin Show.
In the business of pro wrestling, man, I hear a lot of guys, you know, getting concussions and stuff like that. And I don't really understand that because working the style that I worked, which was a very physical style, you know, I know when I got dropped on my head, I was concussed. I was probably, I don't know, man. We know more about, or science knows more about concussions than we did way back in the day, but I don't know more about concussions. I can only speak to think that I only had a few of them. How many concussions do you think you suffered? Because other than a hard ass chair shot or something like that, I just don't understand. Well, like Mick Foley, I can understand why he had a lot of concussions, and I say that with respect because he's a great friend of both of ours. But dude, did you get a bunch of concussions in the business?
I think I may have gotten two, and one was with Perry Saturn. He did a moonsault off the second rope backflip, and his knee caught me right on the chin, and boom, and I went down. He covered me 1-2 kick out. He grabbed a real chin lock, you know, and he called a spot to me, you know. He go, "You ready?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm ready," you know, and my everything went to get up except my legs, you know, and I. I laid back down there and I go, "Wait a minute here, you know, hold on a second, you know," and then I got myself back together. I remember wrestling the Nasty Boys, you know, and, you know, got hit in the head with a big jug of mustard, you know, and, it knocked me silly, you know what I mean? But other than that, man, you know, I think it's the way that, you know, we did go out there to make sure that we was, you know, able to go and, you know, perform the following night. We were, you know, guys, we were great showmen. You know, we were great entertainers. We, you know, we went out there and we pushed it, you know, to a certain level, you know, but I teach here at my school, you know, that, safety first. You know, I got to be able to, I got to make sure I take care of that guy that I'm working with. If I can't take care of that guy that I'm working with, you know, it's going to be a problem. I'm never going to be able to work at the top level because the top level guy is not going to want to work with me. He's going to say, "Hey, man, this guy's, you know, I got to make money." You know what I mean? So therefore, you got to be a guy that can go out there and work with everybody. Your finish that you do, you got to be able to go out there and do it with everyone. And I see guys now that, you know, they don't care about the safety of the guy that they're working with. They just pick them up and just toss them, and how they land. And the thing is, the guy that's getting tossed, he don't care either. You know, so it goes both ways. He just picked me up and shoot the hell out of me. So it's crazy, you know what I mean? So I do try to talk to the young guys and let them know that, hey man, you can still old school, you know, I don't want to try to cross our era with these young guys' era. It's their time.
Yep.
But I do try to tell them, hey, some of the stuff that we did, it still works today. All you got to do is just go out there and utilize it.
Hey, one of the things I forgot to talk about a fight. It was Jeff Neal working with Frank Camacho. And holy shit, man, Jeff Neal. I'd never heard of the guy. Dude, he was just his hands, his speed, his lateral quickness, his movement, his footwork was just premier. And Camacho was a tough ass guy. And at one time, man, he hooked up and told him to bring it. And he was getting his ass whooped. And then second round, and Jeff Neal almost finished him and got saved by the bell. And then
Jeff got that fight though.
Yeah, but he had a ton of heart. But dude, then coming in that second round, Jeff Neal come out of nowhere with that damn kick to the head. Dude, that was one of the worst knockouts I've ever seen.
No, and I tell you, man, he was on Dream Street. So, I mean, he was out before he hit the floor. And that's the thing, you know, Jeff Neal, that's another guy. He's tough. You know, he's a awesome fighter. But that you just said it right there yourself, Steve. You know, with these UFC guys, you never heard of him. You don't know who he was, and so for my entertainment value, you know, I'm not gonna be tuning in and, you know, watch Jeff Neal the next time, you know, the UFC come. I won't remember this guy, and that's the problem, you know, and that's the spotlight, you know, I think the sport need on it more than anything, you know, you and I sitting here talking about just that right there alone is literally what these young guys, you know, I look at, let's talk about him right now. Sage Northcutt, you know, he's a free agent now. You know, he's a young kid, you know, that they were looking to put the rocket on, you know, send this kid straight to the moon. You know what I mean? The kid was going to be getting, you know, nothing but, champagne wishes and caviar dream, you know, from this point on. But this young kid realized how hard it is in the UFC. They keep throwing this guy, you know, hard fights after hard fights after hard fights. You know what I mean? He's gotten beaten a couple of times. If that was a kid of mine, you know, I mean, he'd have an undefeated record. If I was promoting him. If I was the UFC, you know what I mean? This kid, Sage Northcutt, he would have an undefeated record. He would have, action figures like, you know, Ken, the doll. You know what I mean? We would have, you know, video games and a calendar made up and all kind of. This kid would be making all kind of money. But Sage Northcutt chose to become a free agent, opposed to go back and take the money that the UFC is paying him right now. That's what's the problem with the UFC.
When you say he's a free agent, do you mean his contract with UFC is up? Because, you know, he redeemed that one loss. He had a hell of a damn outing, what, about a month or two ago. Had a great fight. He was very aggressive. He's a good-looking kid, a body like a Greek god. I mean, you know, he's a poster boy of one of the fighters that you want to be able to highlight. He's not with the UFC right now?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a big mistake.
He's not with the UFC right now. Right now he's talking about... Yeah, right now he's talking Bellator. Right now he's talking ONE FC. Right now he's talking about, you know, guys out there getting paid. He's actually said, and I quote, he's talked to a lot of his friends out there in other organizations that's making way more money than he's making right now. And when guys start talking like that openly, it means, hey man, some when guys in there going through that kind of this is my point right here, Steve. When guys going out there talking, you know, about money when they're going out there, you know, fighting at that level, it's a problem. When you hear guys at the end of the night say, I'm wishing and hoping I get that $50,000 bonus, I could really use it. You know, how many top professional wrestlers like yourself and I have been worried about a $50,000 bonus?
Right.
How many?
Not too many.
Exactly my point. Because we're getting professional wrestlers, we go out there and we work our butt off, you know, but we get paid very well, you know, for what we do. We go out and do a pay-per-view. We're not talking about, you know, how much money you work in the main event in WrestleMania. You ain't got to go talk about how much money you made. You're a happy man, you know, and when these guys go out and they work in the main event and they still talk about they hoping they get a bonus tonight, that is a problem.
Yeah, it's interesting. But I mean, it's always like, and I can understand the fight of the night and wanting that. I mean, that's incentive. But I mean, for us, it was like, man, if you own a pay-per-view, I mean, it was the same thing every single night in the house show, but more, especially more on a pay-per-view setting. You want to have the best match of the night. You want to steal the show. You know Vince ain't going to pay you no extra bonus. I mean, he could, depending on, you know, sometimes, you know, the sentimental factor would overweigh the number factor that they scientifically use to come up with payoffs. So, I mean, he could feasibly do that. But, no, you weren't thinking, hey, I'm doing this for the bonus. I'm doing this because out of pride, I want to have the best match on the card. And when you set the table by having match after match after match, it's good, and your character's over, you're setting yourself up for bigger paydays down the road.
Bottom line, exactly what I'm saying, you know, seemed like, you know, the reward would come there, you know, sooner or later, you know, but when you hear fighters, you know, like a George St. Pierre, you know, not want to fight because of a money issue, you know, there's a problem. You know what I mean? We never, you know, guys that worked at the top level like us, you know, we never thought about, you know, well, you know, if we were making good money or not. We know we were making good money. We knew, if, you know, our royalty check on our action figures was going to, you know, be, you know, really good just on that alone, you know. But when I watch these guys go out there, you know, and they fight their butt off and they think about, you know, want more money or need more money because they got to pay some bills, it's just a problem there. But these fighters, man, they deserve more, and I think we should advocate for them.
Well, it's interesting because I don't know the pay scale. I do. You do? Okay. I know the pay scale for WWE. But here's the thing, dude. You know, when you got in the business, you can learn how to be a great mechanic. You can learn how to have a character. You can learn your psychology. You put it all together. But along the ways, because it is a business and you've ridden down the road, and I know you've said this just like I have, man, and everybody we know in the business has said this. Oh man, you know, I'm making this kind of money, but I just soon do it for free. That sounds good in theory, but at the bottom, at the end of the day, dude, we're businessmen. If you do not learn the pay structure, and if you don't try to elevate your salary or take the necessary steps to make more money, whether you're in a promotion for wrestling, UFC, or you're a gardener, a landscaper, whatever, you're only going to get, you know, what people want to pay you as less money as they can. That's business. So it's incumbent upon everybody in the business, whether it's pro wrestling, MMA, or whatever, to learn the pay scale or learn your worth and always push. I mean, you heard all the stories about, God rest his soul, Warrior holding up Vince at the last minute for this, that, or whatever, or somebody else holding Vince up right before pay-per-view. Now, that's a bullshit tactic. But wouldn't you agree that you spent the time or took the time to learn the business aspect of the money? Because it ain't like you came from being a super rich family.
No, I mean, you got to know what you're worth. You know what I mean? You got to know if you're better than the guy that's standing next to you. You got to know exactly, you know, if you selling tickets, putting asses in seats, at the same time, that part comes along with it. You know, a lot of these UFC fighters, you know, they don't have that power to say, hey man, I'm a draw, you know, pay me this much money. I understand that point right there. But when certain guys are at that point and they still are talking about money, you know, like just say for instance, you know, a guy become champion and he calls out Dana White and say, Dana, when am I going to get, you know, the big money? And it's the championship fight. You know, he should be talking about money when it's a championship fight. That's the last thing the guy who wins should be talking about. But there again, I made sure I put myself in position to be one of those top guys. I put myself in position by going out there working my ass off, creating the character, going out there and having showmanship, knowing how to make the crowd, you know, feel a certain way at the same time. A lot of these UFC fighters, they don't have character. A lot of these guys are pure testosterone. They go out there and they do one thing and fight. You know, I tell young people all the time, you know, in a UFC fight, you know, these guys ain't thinking about going out there and hitting the guy with a body slam and then going up to the top of the cage and dropping an elbow. They're not thinking about that. They're going out there thinking about seek, destroy, and destruction. That's the only thing those guys think about. So totally, I understand that. But in doing that, they're not building a character. In doing that, they're not building, you know, a bigger following, but they are putting more wear and tear and pain on their bodies at the same time. You know what I mean? So therefore, with the WWE, they create characters. They create their stars. They're the one who's behind, you know, pulling all the strings as far as what guys are going to be getting pushed to the top. You know what I mean? What guys are going to be getting, putting in certain angles, you know, what guys are going to be headline and main event all these pay-per-views that's coming. I look at a guy like Chris Jericho, and this guy, man, he's one of the hardest working men. He's like James Brown. You know what I mean? I mean, he goes out and everything that he's done it at his own, on his own, man, at his own accord, man. He has created everything, you know, as far as, Chris Jericho goes. And to be able to do that is, you know, what a lot of these young guys, you know, hopefully they could take some advice from a guy like that.
When you were talking about pay structure within the UFC or MMA in general, would you agree that Conor McGregor, when he first coming on the scene, dude, and, you know, he has that that aura about him, that chemistry, that it and that X factor, he's talking all that trash, man, and then he's backing it up, and he's just a supreme showman. Then all of a sudden he has the fight with Mayweather, and then he rakes it in on that. And, of course, Mayweather goes to the bank big time in a couple of damn dump trucks. But going back, you know, now Conor's talking about coming back and fighting. I guess it's going to be against Khabib. But he's a guy, to me, that everybody has looked to, especially, I think, the Diaz brothers. Hey, man, if you're paying this sumbitch all that money, then where's mine? So I think he has made a huge case for guys getting paid more money or bucking the system or bucking the promotion demanding more money. And that's what seems to me like that's what a lot more fighters are doing. They're being very selective about their opponents. And it goes to a friend of mine, Daniel Cormier, D.C., wanting that fight with Brock Lesnar because he knows that's going to be the biggest payday of his life. So what are your thoughts on Conor and how he's affected at least the wherewithal about the pay structure?
You know, I got a saying, you know, when you're 100% about something, you speak up 100% of the time. You know, when you're 99%, you keep your mouth shut. You know, Conor McGregor, he came in there, you know, he proved, you know, his worth. He proved how good he was. He proved that he was marketable. He proved that he was bankable as well. You know, even going out there having some tough fights, you know, with, you know, guys like Chad Mendes, you know, going out there with, you know, Nate Diaz, going out there and having that one loss, you know, even having, you know, some tough fights with a couple of other guys. He pulled them off, you know, in grand fashion. And that right there put Conor on the map, as well as Conor got a country behind him. You know what I mean? He got a whole sea of people that's going to follow him as well. And that's what made Conor a little bit different. Now, Conor was willing to bank on himself and say, hey, man, you know, whatever this UFC say, man, screw them, man. I'm going to have this boxing match. And I mean, he got so big. They can say what anything, you know, because they wanted them. Because, you know, when you draw money, you know, hey, people gonna want you, you know, no matter what, you know. So that would put him in a great position, man. He said, I'm gonna go have this fight with Floyd. We're gonna go make this money. I'm gonna put myself in a position where, hey guys, if you want me to come back and fight, it's almost like Tiger Woods back in the day. They used to pay Tiger $1 million just to show up at tournaments, you know. I mean, so with Conor, he got it to the point now to where, hey, if you want me to just show up, pay me to show up, you know, and a lot of fighters can take notes, and you know what I mean, from what he's doing.
Yeah, and you got to, because that's the business side of it, and a lot of people are, you know, like you said, they're going for more money, as they should. Hey, man, when you get back to the main card, and we're all over the place, and, man, we're just shooting the breeze. I ain't no technical damn broadcaster as me and
Booker. Hey,
man. Talking about pro wrestling. We're talking about money. We're talking about the UFC. I don't really give a shit. But, dude, Abdul Razak Al-Hassan goes out there against Nico Price. And the interesting thing about Nico Price, last time he was out there, he won that fight knocking the dude out with a hammer fist. And on that pay-per-view, a month or two ago, whenever that fight was, there was two hammer fist knockouts, which you don't really see that. But, I mean, he won in spectacular fashion. Dude, all of a sudden, he goes out there with Abdul Razak Al-Hassan, And that match literally lasted, I think that fight lasted about, 40 seconds?
Yeah.
Dude, and then Nico came out there and hit him with the right hand, and I said, okay, he's got a little bit of height on him. He's got that range. And it's like Abdul, man, he stayed right within range. And so Nico couldn't get off. He didn't get off. And all of a sudden, like in the promo afterwards, when he was talking to Joe Rogan, he says, man, when people want to stand and trade with me, I just get mad and I start throwing back. And dude, he hit him with a shot and just knocked his damn dick in the dirt.
No, I tell you, one thing about the 228 was, the prelims literally stole the show. I can't even remember the two girls that was fighting. It wasn't as far as it was the other two girls, man. I had never seen them fight before, but they just beat each other up and bloodied each other up like, you know, I've never seen before. And that was really, really cool. These guys, they're going to come out there, man. They're going to fight, you know. No shame in their game as far as coming out there putting on the show. These guys, they go out there and they put their chin out there and they take a shot. I mean, Darren Till actually, I'm jumping around,
yeah,
but Darren Till was taking elbows to the face and he was laughing about it. You know, I mean, that kind of stuff right there. When I see that with these guys, man, they truly believe, I mean, especially with the women, man, just like Esparza, like you say, you got to give her so much credit because of the beating that she took. They will go out there and fight to the end. And that's what I wonder about the UFC fighter, man. What do they get that from, man? What does that come from going in there? Knowing that that's getting ready to happen. Knowing, you know, it's a possibility. It's not like going out there swinging a tennis racket like Serena Williams and breaking down or anything like that. You going out there getting hit with shots and standing up for another shot. That's what's so impressive about these UFC fighters, man.
But I always figure, man, like I think guys that got in the business that we got into, we're wired a little bit different. I think when you get in the fight game, you're definitely wired different. I mean, everybody's wired to do whatever they end up doing, but it's a different mindset. But a question I wanted to ask you, just as far as we're talking toughness, we're talking evolution of MMA, we're talking pro wrestling. One of the things that impressed me about the preliminary card coming from the winners and from the main card, man, there were some really, really good promos done after the fight conducted by Joe Rogan. And because, man, we come from the business of selling tickets, I've seen many guys, or many girls, but mainly guys, they get out there and all of a sudden Joe's trying to interview them, and it's just a stream of F-bombs or just some kind of bullshit message that don't make no sense. But I always feel like that mic time, I can only imagine what it feels like to feel what they've been through, the adrenaline rush, the beatings, everything, the physicality. And then all of a sudden someone sticks a mic in your face and it's time to make some money. I thought, man, there were some great promos. There were some very humble promos. I mean, like Tatiana Suarez, yeah, what she said.
Yeah.
I mean, same thing,
yeah,
with Aljamain Sterling talking about how tough Cody was. Jeff, yeah, Neal talking about how tough Camacho was. And Darren Stewart, yeah, with the British accent. I think those guys all improved their stock and all made money. Same thing with Al Hassan. When he takes down Nico Price, he gives him credit. But everybody was really well-spoken on this event. And that always impresses me because I'm looking at the fights. I'm buying it for the fights, but I'm also, man, I'm looking for that guy who's going to get that mic time and put himself in a better position, either one with the promotion or two with,
yeah,
the people,
yeah,
and making money and taking advantage, because you don't always get that at bat. And when you do,
yeah,
you got to be, have the wherewithal to take advantage of that damn shining moment when Rogan or,
yeah,
whoever it is gives you that time. Do you agree with me?
You know, man, I look at the, like you say, everybody was humble, you know, and you're supposed to be, you know, I mean, it's a pugilist game, you know what I mean? And it's about respect and whatnot. But the guys who make the money and put themselves in position for the big fights are the guys who are the best talkers, you know what I mean? The guys like Chael Sonnen, you know what I mean? A guy like Mickey Gall, as of late, Mickey Gall, I mean, called out, you know, CM Punk, and that one fight put Mickey Gall's name, you know, in the books, and he went out and cashed in on it, you know? So my thing is, cutting a promo is something that these guys really do need to learn how to do. Cutting a promo is a class, perhaps, that these UFC guys need to take, because, you know, going out there and Muhammad Ali said, it's going to be a thriller of a chiller when I get to Gorilla in Manila. You know, that right there, you know, made me want to tune in. Yeah. You know, it's a gorilla about to get beat up, you know, in Africa, you know what I mean? I mean, in the Philippines, you know, so that right there, Muhammad Ali, you know, he, you know, I mean, Gorgeous George, these guys were, are the reason the fight game is what it is. And you got to know how, like you say, know how to capitalize off that 30 seconds to that minute, that you have in front of you. You can't buy that time in front of the world. You should know that, as well as you should have someone coaching you on that right there. Hey, have you worked on your promo in case you win the fight?
I know, but you're always thinking about the next step. And like, dude, I always appreciate the humble people, but I love the trash talkers. It's like an old interview with GSP. He was like, he loves to hear all the people talk trash. But for him, that just wasn't how he operated. He was always that humble guy. And it's like, here's another guy, like a straight up killer like Cain Velasquez. He's not going to talk a whole lot of trash, but everybody that knows that Cain's a cardio machine, he's an absolute beast. He's been a little bit injured. Yeah. He had a good win not too long ago. But I mean, for me, Cain's not a guy that's going to sell me on a match with his mouth. I just want to know if Cain's fighting and he's got a good opponent, I'm buying that event. And going back to what you said about Chael Sonnen, I remember years ago, he talked himself into that fight with Anderson Silva by running his mouth.
Oh, yeah.
And he was talking all that trash. And I said, man, I wasn't even going to buy that UFC event. But because of Chael Sonnen's promo, because I figured Anderson Silva was going to crush him. But Chael was talking so much shit, I said, I'm buying that. And our friend, DDP, Diamond Dallas Page, came over and he goes, bro, you buying the fights? And I said, yeah. He goes, can I come watch them with you? I said, just bring it on. Man, for five rounds, Chael Sonnen was beating his ass. And all of a sudden he got on top of him, and me and Dallas were on the edge of our seat. And I kept saying, dude, he's going to catch you in a chokehold or something. It was like dangling a lure in front of a big mouse bass. And boy, he took it and tapped him out. And I was so invested in that match book. I mean, and I love Anderson Silva. He's one of my favorite fighters of all time. Chael Sonnen had so much heart. He was winning that fight. And I was like, you got to be shitting me.
Yeah. But not only that, he talked his way into two fights. You know what I mean? So, cause he got a rematch after that right there. You know, and Chael's always been good, man. Even in WEC, man, he talked his way into a title shot there. And, you know, he got beat, same thing, winning the fight, you know, and showed up, you know, last round, got tapped out. But Chael Sonnen has always been a guy who has put himself in position. He's always been a star, you know, and whether he's been the greatest fighter on the card or not, he's always been a star. He always believed that he was top five. I can tell you that right now. And that's what makes Chael Sonnen and guys like him, you know, the money makers, you know, in that sport.
You're listening to another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show, only on Podcast One.
And that's funny because it's not funny, but it's, you know, when they've got them all lined up at a table and it's Connor and he's stealing the show because he can run his mouth, or it's Chael when he's up there in that line of fighters, because a lot of fighters, that's what they do. They just fight. But those guys just operate at a different level, or just born with the gift of gab, but they command your attention by their presence and with their mouth, and in doing so, get themselves over with the fans, over with the promotion because of the interest, and put themselves in big money fights.
Do you think Conor McGregor is going to be able to talk his way out of this ass whooping that he's going to have coming with Khabib Nurmagomedov?
But dude,
that's the question.
The last few fights I've seen in Khabib, man, he just swarms on you, and he gets you down, and he starts climbing up, and all of a sudden he's on you like a boa constrictor. I ain't never seen nothing like the guy, but it will be interesting because One thing that I really think about Conor McGregor, he's a, and it's one of the things I love so much about DC in his fight with Stipe. He's such a smart fighter. He's very cerebral. The same thing with Conor. He's a smart fighter. And if he can connect with that right hand, I mean, I believe he carries way more power than he gets credit for, but he's so athletic and dynamic. I don't know. It's going to be an interesting fight. Who do you see winning that fight?
You got to look at it, man. I mean, Conor's good, man. The only time he's had trouble is when he's on his back. You know, standing up, Conor's always been, you know, superb. He's always been magnificent standing up, you know. But every time, you know, he's had, had problems on his back, he's gotten beat up just a little bit. Nate Diaz, Mendez fought him on a 3-week notice and took him down on several occasions. Khabib take Conor McGregor down, it's going to be a long night of beating for Conor McGregor. And we notice, you know, when he gets tired, when Conor gets tired, he's not the same fighter. And Khabib, he's a pressure fighter. You got to be willing to go for 5 rounds pressure and have win for 5 rounds. This is a guy who hadn't fought since he, fought Mayweather, you know what I mean, in a boxing match. He hadn't been in the octagon in quite some time, and now he's coming back against a guy of this caliber, Nurmagomedov. I don't see it being a good fight to come back to, me personally. If I was him, I would say, hey, man, give me a warm-up. I'm Conor McGregor. I got $100 million in the bank. But I don't need to fight this guy.
But it's interesting to see the way Conor can get in a guy's head, because I truly believe he got in Jose Aldo's head way back in the day, and all of a sudden, here comes Jose Aldo. They charge each other, and Aldo gets clipped. It's a knockout in 14 seconds. And of course,
it was, but
he flashed him. But I think he got in his head. But I really don't think he'll be able to get into Khabib's head.
I don't think he's going to be able to get into Khabib's head. I mean, it's not like that fight right there. That fight was it was beautiful the way Conor went out there and, you know, finished it off. You know, spectacular highlight knockout. But with this guy, Khabib, I've been watching the fight game for quite some time, and I've never seen a guy that fight. Like I say, levels of the fight game. This is a guy that fight at a different level. And when I saw him beat the Brazilian kid. What was the Brazilian kid? I can't think of his name right now. Big time kicker. But Nurmagomedov went out and beat him so bad. And this is a guy that, you know, sometimes you say, man, I mean, he's spectacular. I can't think of his name right now. But I tell you, this guy is something special. He's something that Conor McGregor, if I was Conor, I would not want no pieces of this fight right now. But this shows you the balls of Conor McGregor. This shows you what kind of man Conor McGregor is. These Irishmen, man, they don't duck nobody. They're fighters. You know, and for Conor McGregor to come back for his first fight back in the UFC to take on this fight, it shows exactly what kind of man he really is. So I give him a whole lot of credit for it.
Boy, and it's going to sell a whole lot of pay-per-views, but back, I cannot remember Khabib's opponent either, but it was a high-level guy. But it was a fight that reminded me a whole lot of the Tatiana Suarez versus Carla Esparza match, because
it was total
domination and destruction.
Edson Barbosa, that's what it was.
Yeah.
Edson Barbosa. He's explosive. He's a really good fighter. And I tell you, Khabib, like you say, climbed on him and crawled on him like, you know, a snake, man, and made that man look like he had been through a war. And Khabib didn't have a scratch on him at the end of the night. And the thing is, he didn't even look tired at the end of the night. You know what I mean? So that's the thing that I think that Conor's going to have to deal with more than anything.
And I don't know the headspace or the mindset that these guys are into, because that's not my game. I just like to watch it. But to me, that Khabib has that presence about him where, if you go back when Ronda started running through everybody with those like 6 or 7, you know, armbar submissions, it was like she come down that damn ramp with that BMF walk, and she was so intimidating. She was in a lot of people's heads. I believe that Khabib possesses the same type of thing. He comes down with that gimmick fur hat. It's like, dude's out of Russia or wherever he's from. And he has that intimidation factor. And I don't know how, easily intimidated people are out there. But dude, you know, the weigh-ins or just right there at the introduction inside the octagon, you know, they're giving each other the stare down, trying to get in each other's head. So
yeah, yeah.
It's going to be an interesting fight.
I mean, you know, I mean, in life, you know, you can look a man in his eye and tell if you want to test him or not, you know, and Khabib is one of those type of guys. He's not a guy you're going to look at and intimidate. He's not a guy that you're going to see at a bar and say, hey, man, move over to the next stool. You know, he's not, and he do it. You know, he's going to just go to, you know, beating up on you. That's the mentality, you know, of a guy like Khabib. So I do not see Conor McGregor bullying Khabib. I don't see him coming back intimidating Khabib because, like I said, you can look in a man's eye and tell if you want to deal with it. Everybody always knew about Haku, you know what I mean, in our business. I never got into a fight with Haku or anything like that. We never, were in any beef, and I made sure of that, you know, but I do know that he's not a guy that I wanted to actually get into it. If I had to, I would have had to, you know, try to hold my own. But I do know he's not a guy that I wanted to get into it with. I just knew that.
Right. Let's move on because Jimmy Rivera defeated John Dodson by unanimous decision. You know, great movement by Rivera. I mean, Dodson is a real quick cat. Just to me, he couldn't really get off. And Rivera, with the pressure, was more active. And so the fight was what it was.
It was simple. Rivera is a guy that's on the way up, man. Rivera is a guy that's a tough guy. He's a tough customer. He's a guy that's going to be around. You're going to be talking about him for the next, you know, 3 to 5 years. You're going to be talking about Rivera. John Dodson, he's a guy that's put in a lot of work. He's a guy who's had a lot of title shots. He's a guy who's, you know, been in a lot of wars. He's a guy who's been knocked out before. You know, I always say you get knocked out in the sport, you know, just one time, you're never the same fighter ever again. You might be good, but you're never the same fighter. I go out there and get knocked out. And John Dodson, man, he's been, you know, he's been great for the sport. I mean, he's been around so long, he's got an afro now. That's how long he's been around.
And then the next fight, Brandon Davis was filling in on short notice for somebody, but at the Zabit Magab,
oh my God,
Sharipov, submitted him with a knee bar, and this was the second knee bar submission we saw that night because that's what Aljamain Sterling defeated Cody Stamann with. But man, that thing went to the side, and like I said, man, he tore out his LCLs, and man, he was in a bad way. So Brandon Davis taps out. I mean, dude, to get that hold and to submit that guy, and that was a hamstring thing. But anyway, it was a hell of a fight, and
it was creative.
Zabit has he has that aura about him. I thought Brandon Davis tested him a little bit more than I thought he was going to test him, because you normally on a short fill-in, like you said, Chad Mendez gave Conor a hell of a fight there for a little bit way back in the day.
Well,
but Brandon Davis fared well, but this kid is special.
It was creative, man. I mean, to see a tap out like that, to see a move, you know, just like Aljamain Sterling, man. I mean, I don't know. You know, I don't know what's in those guys, man. I actually seen, you know, one of the Nogueira brothers, you know, with Frank Mir, you know, get his arm broken, you know, and he actually looked at it. He didn't even go, ow. You know, that's what impressed me even more. He just looked at his arm like, hey, I think he just broke my arm, you know, and I was like, you know, so when I see these fighters, you know, go out there, you know, like the Jermaine Sterling fight, like that Zabit fight, it's very impressive, man. These guys, you know, they go out there and they put themselves through stuff that I can't even imagine putting myself through. I can't even imagine going out there, letting the guy lock my leg up like that and pulling on it, and I know it has a chance of breaking. I'm tapping, you know, as soon as he starts to touch the ankle. That's the time. That's what I'm doing. You know what I mean? So it amazes me when I see that, you know. So, but I did there again, another guy going to the hospital. But there again, a great win, and I was thoroughly entertained.
Man, when you talk about the Jess Andrade match fight against Carolina Kowalkiewicz, you know, back in the day, you know, a few years ago, Carolina got over when she was fighting Joanna Jędrzejczyk because she's two Polish chicks going at it. And, you know, at that time, Joanna was the champion, and Carolina went out there and gave her a hell of a fight. And she was so unassuming, just kind of standing against the cage, just like she was before this match. You know, when she came out of that fight with Joanna, she got beat. But because she was just such a this well-spoken sweetheart who happens to be a badass, but because she handled the beating or the loss in the fashion that she did, she got over with that crowd, and that set her course through a loss.
Yeah, yeah.
And then but against you, Jessica Andrade, holy smokes, man, she climbed up there, and that was just absolutely brutal.
Man, it was almost criminal. That's what it was. Because that's what I'm talking about, man. To see that, man, I cannot imagine, you know, my wife Charmelle taking a beat down like that without me throwing in the towel and saying, baby, come on now. We got things to do. You know, so it always amazes me when I see these women go out and, you know, lay it out like that, man. They love it. You know, they love the sport, you know, and they're willing to go out there and leave it all in the cage like that. It's unbelievable.
But in the pre-fight interview, she said that she was going to apply pressure, and she said she's going to apply so much pressure she's going to break her. And, man, she wasn't bullshitting. It was pressure out the ass. And she caught her with some good shots.
But it was pressure from both sides, though. It was a slobber knock.
No, Carolina came back with a couple of shots, but then all of a sudden, when Andrade really turns it on, dude.
Jessica is a tough girl. Jessica's had, you know, she had title shots. She's a girl that's been, you know, at the elite level. And just like the main event that pulled out, you know, Shevchenko. When they fight at that level right there, they are the elite of the sport. Andrade, she falls into that category. Let's talk about that fight right there. As far as Nico Montaño pulling out of that fight, with Shevchenko. What do you think about that?
Well, dude, I'm glad you brought that up, because all of a sudden I'm looking at the card. My buddy that I always talk UFC, Joe Romero, was telling me about, you know, how bad, you know, Shevchenko is. And then all of a sudden, man, I had never heard of what's her name? Monica?
Nico Montaño.
Yeah, Nico Montaño. And then she pulls out of the fight, and it seems like Shevchenko was kind of predicting it. I didn't even know how, I'd never heard of that woman's name, and I didn't know how she got the belt or if it was an interim belt. Well, dude, what was the story on that, and was it a tough weight cut for her?
You know, see, that's the thing, man. I said the same thing. I was talking to my partner, Brad Gilmore, about this fight, and, Nico Montaño, she won the fight in the Ultimate Fighter. They did a Ultimate Fighter with the women, and the winner was become the first, flyweight champion. And, that's great and all, but me personally, if you win the Ultimate Fighter, I think you should just get an Ultimate Fighter belt. You should get a title that you got to go out there and defend against the best in the world, because you're actually not the best in the world. You just won a tournament with a lot of other girls trying to come up, almost like getting a tryout.
Right.
You know what I mean? It did her first title shot. They throw her in there with the baddest chick, of not one of the baddest chick in the UFC, Valentina Shevchenko. I would have pulled out of the fight too. I would have said, no, this ain't right. Forget this. I'm not doing it. Because I just thought that, that Nico was, she was good at what she did in the Ultimate Fighter, but she was nowhere near the caliber of fighter that they were. It was a mismatch, and I just didn't like the matchup.
But from what I heard of it, I heard she put heat on herself by backing out of the fight.
Well, she put heat on herself, but I would have backed out of the fight too, because she was going to take a beating that she has never taken before. I just don't think that, like you say, that title that she got, it wasn't an interim championship. It was supposed to be a legitimate championship with a bunch of contestants. I don't see a title being created that way. If you're going to create a championship of that caliber, you let the girls who actually going to be in that division that's in the UFC be a part of that. They should be excluded from that process. So I just think it was wrong and outright for the UFC to put Nico Montaño, a person that you don't even know, Steve, you never heard of before, in a fight with someone the caliber of a Valentina Shevchenko. It would have been a rout.
Well,
in my estimation.
Poor well taken, and I get it. But finally, let's go to the main event. Tyron Woodley against Darren Till. And Till was the favorite going into this fight.
Why?
That's what I'm asking you, because it just, to me, you know, Tyron Woodley just doesn't seem to get the respect that he deserves. I mean, to me, like the two Wonder Boy fights, stylistically, Wonder Boy is a hard matchup for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Then Tyron Woodley, maybe he's heavy handed. He's a wrestler. And those fights were what they were. And I'm a Tyron fan, but all of a sudden they start showing me highlights of Darren Till. And here's the thing, Book. I had never heard of Darren Till, but obviously.
You never heard of him before either.
No, dude. And he's a 25-year-old stud from England. He's got a bright, bright future ahead of him. But I tell you what, I think Tyron was a little bit, I think he was a little, damn sure he felt disrespected. But man, what a game plan he went in there with. And man, I don't know what they call it, the Darce choke or whatever. And I think they covered it on the announcement. And, Tyron is not a submission specialist. And to tap that guy out with a submission, it was a pretty spectacular fight.
Yeah, but Tyron is a great wrestler, man. He's a guy that's got a wrestling background. He's a guy that's been fighting for quite some time. You know, Strikeforce, he was a young kid, just like Darren Till was, once upon a time, undefeated, went in there and get knocked out against Nate Marquardt as well. So he's a guy that's, learned through trial and tribulations. You got to be humble in the game. You got to work on your craft all the time. And you got to be ready when that opportunity comes. Darren Till had a huge opportunity. A guy that's 17-0, going into this fight. 17-0, he's a guy that, 15 of those fighters, you don't even know who they are, but the last two was Stephen Thompson and Don Cerrone. And, Don Cerrone, he's a guy who sometimes Don Cerrone shows up. Sometimes he don't. You know what I mean? Sometimes he won't drink a few beers and, just go in and have a fight and not train too hard. Sometimes Don Cerrone goes into a fight knowing he's going to lose. That's the type of fighter Don Cerrone is. Stephen Thompson, and Teal fight, those two big guys, kind of like, canceled each other out. No one really, beat each other up in that fight right there. And on that alone, the UFC gave this guy a title shot after Tyron Woodley has done nothing but one thing in the UFC, and that's win. The only thing he's done is win in the UFC. And there again, Dana White, he threw a lot of shade on Tyron Woodley not being a star, not stepping up and when the opportunity came to become a star. But when you're the champion, I think you're already a star. I don't understand that. When you're the champ, the welterweight champion who was defended three times, one guy against Damian Maia shouldn't have never gotten a title shot. Damian Maia, only title shot he's ever gotten in the UFC was against Tyron Woodley because they wanted the belt off of him. Stephen Wonderboy Thompson, who did he beat to get a title shot? He didn't beat but a couple of guys, and he got a title shot. And then Stephen Thompson, the challenger, gets a rematch. When have the challenger got a rematch in any sport? I don't understand. This kid here, come along, Darren Till, he's a young kid. He's 6 foot tall. He's long. He's rangy. He's not even actually a welterweight. He's actually bigger. We got to get the belt off Tyron Woodley because he's bucking the system. He's not going the way he's not rolling the way we want him to roll when we tell him to roll that way. You know what I mean? So the thing is, it was all about getting the title off, Tyron Woodley. But Tyron Woodley proved to the UFC, like he's been proving since day one, he is a prize fighter. He's very tactical, and he can beat anybody on any given Sunday with that big right hand. If he touch you with that right hand, you're going to feel it. You're going to go down, and ground and pound came there shortly after, and then choke out. The kid fought hard. He got valiant, but he took a beating that he never thought he was going to take.
And, dude, here's the thing about Tyron Woodley, man. For me, he's kind of like a guy like Cain Velasquez. He ain't going to talk a whole lot of shit, but here's the thing. When Tyron's talking, I'm listening because he's a serious guy. He takes what he's doing very serious, but he doesn't have to talk me into a fight. I'm a fan of his because I like the way he conducts business. I like the way he fights. I like his professionalism. I like the way he attacks the task at hand, and he's proud to be that champion. And it's going to take a real sumbitch to take that belt off of him.
Tyron said exactly the same thing you just said. Tyron Woodley said, everyone else likes me. Everyone else thinks, I'm a cool guy except Dana White. I'm serious.
Yeah, he did.
He's doing movies. He's out in Hollywood. He's doing movies and stuff. People, doing so much. And the thing is,
if you got a champion that's winning, I don't know why you're not pushing them. You know, it would have been great to get the title on Darren Till, because there you would have had England, you would have had another country in play right there. You know what I mean? It would have been great to get the title on Damian Maia, because boom, then you got Brazil, you got a country, you know, behind them. You know what I mean? So my thing is this, Tyron Woodley, it's going to take, like you say, a hell of a fighter to go out there and take the title off that guy. Right now, who do you see? I mean, Kobe Covington. I really think Kobe Covington is going to take the same thing all the rest of those guys took. And I think Kobe Covington is going to take it even a little bit worse than most, just because of the crap he's been talking.
Well, it's interesting because a lot of people don't like it. He's a different kind of trash talker, and he gets heat with a lot of people. You know, trash is trash, man. So I dig it. He entertains me. I think he's a good fighter. Is he a great fighter? I don't know that yet. But it'll be interesting to see what they do next. One of the things I was going to ask you about leading into this fight, that Wonderboy, I think, was complaining a little bit about the low blows or the low strikes that Darren Till was kicking him in the knees.
The oblique kick.
Yeah, but he was also, you know, hell, man, Anderson Silva used to do the same thing. I mean, he'd disrupt you. I mean, that was as a completely legal tactic, but I'd heard that, you know, Wonderboy was making some mention of this. So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, it's a fight, dude, but all of a sudden, when you're kicking at that knee and the knee's not supposed to bend that way, do you outlaw that, or what do you do?
Me personally, I'm not a huge fan of the oblique kick, you know.
I'm not a fan either because of what it is.
No, because the fighter has to have a fighting stance, you know. When a fighter doesn't have the ability to have a fighting stance, it becomes, you know, something other than a real fight to me. You know what I mean? I think level playing field, because most in the fight game don't throw that kick. You only see Holly Holm threw that kick. You know, only a couple of Anderson Silva, like you say, threw that kick. But very few fighters actually perfect that, because, you know, they're not going to be using it. You know what I mean? So I'm not a huge fan of it. I don't think it's something that should be in the UFC. It's something that could blow someone's knee out immediately. Now, taking someone and putting them in a certain hole and their knee go, that's one thing. But just to kick it from that perspective, now side kick or inside kick, that's perfectly fine. But an oblique kick, when you intentionally, you know, knowing this is the spot to blow a person's knee out, I just don't think it's something that's cool in the game. I just don't like it.
Hey, man, wrapping this thing up.
No. Before we wrap it up. I gotta know, man. I gotta know. People want to know. When I first got to WWE, I gotta know. When I first got to WWE, Bruce Pritchard, you know, he talked about it. You know what I mean? And you and I, we never talked about it. You know what I mean? I gotta know. You know, when I first got to WWE, you know, you remember that.
Yeah.
You know, I came to the ring, jumped over the barrier, you know, Steve Austin, you know, dropped him on the table, boom, you know, big debut, you know, Booker T's in and whatnot. You know, I leave the arena that night. I don't know why we didn't talk. I can't remember why. But I do know I left the arena. What happened? Bruce Pritchard called me. I'm on my way to the next town. Bruce Pritchard said, "Hey, man, you know what was going on?" I say, "Man, it was a great night tonight. You know what I mean? I'm excited, man. I'm in the WWE." You know, he goes, "No, man, you didn't hear what happened." I go, "No, what are you talking about?" He goes, "No, you broke Steve's hand." And I go, "Broke Steve's hand?" He goes, "Yeah, man, you need to, you know, you gotta fix it." You know, I go, "Fix what? What are you talking about?" He goes, man, you gotta fix it, man." I said, "Well, give me Steve's number and let me call him. This is my debut, WWE." I said, "Let me call Steve and let me apologize for breaking this man's hand, because that wasn't my intention." You know what I mean? I do remember seeing you hit the top of the announce table and bouncing off. I remember that. But he goes, "No, you need to meet Steve in his hotel room tomorrow, man. And, you know, you need to pack his bags to the hotel, man, because, you know, man, we got to fix this." And I look at, I tell Richard on the phone, I go, "Hold him up. I ain't packing no goddamn bags." I call him, you know what I mean? But give me your insight on that story.
Well, here's the thing. I had heard that story told many times, almost just like that. And first of all, had you called me to pack my bags, I would have said, no, I got it, because nobody has ever carried my bags. Nobody's ever packed my bags but me. But there was never no heat. But here's the deal, Book. If I remember correctly, that was at Meadowlands Arena in New Jersey, correct?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay, yep. You pick me up over the shoulder, bam, I hit the table. The deal was, I was so slippery from being so sweaty. You know how those tables are. You never know what they're going to do. Well, what happened was, when I flat backed on that table, I just skipped off like someone skimming a rock off a surface of a pond, right? And when I did, my lower back hit the legs of one of those announcer's chairs, you know, with all the padding on them. So it's a heavy-duty chair. So what happened was, I'd broken three transverse processes in my back. Those things that stick out, all three of them just snapped over. So my hand was never broken. I broke those three bones in my back, and I went to the back. And, man, I was like, God damn, man. It wasn't nothing you did. It was the way the bump went. And so you put me perfect on the table. I just skipped off. But I had broken three bones in my back, and I kept telling the guys, I said, listen, man, I said, there's something wrong with me. I said, my back's got to be broke. And so they took me to the hospital. Was it that night or when I went home? I can't remember. And I got an x-ray. Well, they didn't turn the x-ray machine up high enough, so you couldn't see nothing. They said, no, man, you're fine. And I said, I'm telling you, man, there's something wrong with my back. So I went to San Antonio when I was living. And sure enough, I go in there. They turn the x-ray up to a proper damn, you know, whatever setting for my girth. I said, no, you got good news and bad news. He said, the bad news is you broke three of the transverse processes in your back. But the good news is when they fold over, we just leave them like that. So we're not going to fix it. It'll just heal up and you'll be fine. So then from that day forward, you know, I started going back to TV. There would be a doctor waiting for me in the dressing room before every show. And this is kind of leading into when I started doing a lot of the comedy stuff with Kurt Angle, because the doctor would be in there. We'd meet in the bathroom. I'd have 60 milligrams of Toradol shot in my ass. Now, Toradol is a it's a pain blocker.
Non-narcotic, yeah.
Yes, non-narcotic pain blocker, but it works like a mug. It's like a miracle drug. So before the shows, every show, I was on the road or if I was working a tag or whatever, until my back healed up, someone was shooting me full of Toradol. And that's why I started doing those comedy skits with Kurt, because I couldn't get no heat. Because I was hurt, I couldn't do anything to anybody.
I never do that, man. I swear, man. I never do that, man.
No, you never broke my hand. And when you put me through the table, it wasn't your fault. I hit the table. I skipped off. It was just a fluke that my back hit the chair.
You know what? If I remember, my thing is, I don't remember a whole lot of stuff, you know, about wrestling and wrestling spots, but I remember that night vividly, and I remember going over that, and they told me, okay, what's going to happen is, I remember going over, they're going to remove everything, they take the TVs out, take the top off, and none of that was done, and boom, I hit, and all of that stuff was still, so when you landed right on that little top part, which shouldn't have been there, and I thought those TVs should have been removed as well, and that's what I remember to that. And to this day, man, we never talked about that. And I've heard several stories. Like I said, Bruce told that story to me, but I do remember hearing JR tell this story that you just said, and that's the first time I had ever heard about it. So I just want to hear from you, man, because I always wondered about that.
I know, and I love Bruce Pritchard, and he helped me out tremendously when I was in WWE, but that's not the correct story. And Bruce is a premier storyteller. You know, he grew up watching Houston wrestling just like you and me did.
That's the problem. I think that's the problem. Bruce just tried to get some material for his show. That's what it was.
You know, controversy creates cash, which is a book written by Eric Bischoff. But no, he's got the story. Now, Bruce is a great storyteller. I consider him a good friend. But no, he had the story wrong. It was my back, and there was never no heat with you and me, because all of a sudden I started seeing some Twitter stuff. This is a year or two ago, whatever it was. All of a sudden, you're supposed to be carrying my bags and shit like this. And I was like, no, that's bullshit. That never happened. You and me never had no heat. And that was the damn truth.
I know it, man. I just wanted to get it out. Like I said, I just had to hear it myself, because I've been wondering myself about that night for all these years, man. All these freaking years, I've been wondering. Because I'm riding down the highway and freaking Bruce calls me, man,
you need to make it right.
Oh, and you know how Bruce is when he's getting dramatic. You need to make it right. I mean, like, what are you supposed to do? Hey, but here's a story for you. I got a story for you, though. One time we was over in Germany. This is when I was with WCW, and we didn't go to Germany or Europe very much. We really started doing that in WWF. But anyway, we went over there, and I was out drinking like a fish. I didn't have a hangover. I caught the flu. Dude, we were walking through the airport, international travel. We're coming back to the States. I am sick as a dog book. I consider myself a pretty tough guy. Am I the toughest guy walking there? No, but I'm going to work hurt. I finished a match after almost getting paralyzed. Now a flu bug has got me, and dude, I got a stomach ache from hell. I'm sweating bullets. I put my passport in. I get through. And man, I'm dragging my bags. I got a black Toomey. Everybody was carrying Toomeys back in the day. And there was Sting. Sting was a world champion. And dude, Booker, I'm selling like a mug. And I look at Sting because it was almost like a dude crawling across the desert trying to get some water. And I said, Sting, I said, man, I ain't feeling good, man. Could you carry my bag for me? And Sting looked at me like, I just fell out of a dog's ass. He ain't gonna care my damn bags for me. But Book, that is the only time I've ever asked somebody to carry my bags, and I wouldn't carry no bags to get up a favor or get a push. I was sick as a son of a bitch. Holy smokes! And Sting would carry my bags. I said, well, I guess I better grind it out and get my ass on the airplane. Booker, I sat down on that airplane, and I think I had upgraded to first class because this is before. Or, you know, I could even get first class. I might have been coach. I don't remember. But, dude, those flight attendants took care of me because it was about an 8 or 10 hour flight back to the States.
Yeah, right.
And man, to get those barf bags that nobody ever uses. Yeah. Dude, I filled up probably 6 or 8 of those on that flight back. Man. And they would just take them from me and hand me another one. And I'll never forget. And by that time, the bug had worked itself out. But I'll never forget, man, I thanked them from the bottom of my heart for taking care of my sick ass.
That's best time. Sting still didn't pack your bag, though.
Hey, but I want to come to Houston and do a podcast just about wrestling and your life. But I'm going to do that one of these days. But I know you got a radio show. You got a wrestling school. I know you're on social media. Bring people that listen to my podcast up to speed with the stuff that they can find you and check out all the stuff that you're doing because you're very busy down in Houston, Texas.
Heated Conversations, it's the radio show on Sports Radio 16. Download radio.com app. You know, if you want to check it out around the world, you can check it out anywhere. Reality of Wrestling, of course, go to realityofwrestling.com. Catch me at Booker T5X on Twitter and Instagram and whatnot, you know. So, but my Reality of Wrestling, man, that's my pride and joy right now. You can check it out streaming every Sunday on Fight TV. You know, check it out, man. It's an awesome show. Leave me a comment. Let me know what you're thinking about it. And we're trying to get that to the next level. And hopefully we can get Stone Cold Steve Austin down here to make an appearance or something like that.
Hey, man, if WWE gives me the blessings, you know I will. Speaking of WWE, how tied in with those guys are you still? Are you still a part of the company? And did you do your thing?
I'm still working every week. I mean, every month. I'm still doing the pay-per-views. You know, I was just on SmackDown just a couple of weeks ago over in Canada, which was awesome, you know what I mean, to get back out there and have some fun with New Day. It was cool doing the Spinneroonie, you know, just bringing that out. I hadn't done the Spinneroonie in 2 years. But I love still being a part of the company, man. I love being an ambassador. I love being around the young guys, man. They keep me young. I love being able to, you know, give them that knowledge, man, as well as, you know, push them to the next level, man. They need someone like you and I, you know, telling them, hey, man, go out there and do your thing, man. You know, I got a chance to talk with Bray Wyatt one day, man. He told me, man, no one's never talked to me like this before. You know what I mean? And to be able to do that with these young guys, man. Hey, I love it, man. I remember Ox Baker told me one day, man, he didn't have to do it, but he pulled me aside and he said, hey, kid, you got a lot of talent, man. He said, you're going to make a lot of money in this business one day. He said, but you're going to come up against a lot of obstacles. He said, you just got to figure a way over them, round them, under them. Sometimes you got to go through them. It was important for me to have someone like Ox Baker putting that thought in my head. And the thing is, he didn't have to. And for me to be able to do it with these young guys, man, it's freaking awesome.
it's always great to get information from the veterans who have been there, done that, and take the time to pass that knowledge along. So I'm with you. I'm right in the same boat with you. My last question is, I've been hearing rumblings. I don't know if it's a shoot. I don't know if it's bullshit. Shawn Michaels trying to talk him into another match after he said he'd never have another match. I don't know what's going to happen with that. We'll see. My question to you is, we know I'm done. Everybody's known I'm done. I always tell everybody I'm done. I'm not going to have another match. But does Booker T have another match in him in a WWE squared circle 20 by 20?
Well, I tell you right now, man, if WWE was to call me and say, hey, Book, we want you to do a match, you know, with Stone Cold Steve Austin, I'd do it. You know what I mean? I'd do it in a heartbeat. You know, but I'm not, look, I've scratched every itch, I've ever had to, in the business, man, as far as working go. But I do want to have one more match. Here at Reality of Wrestling, you know, one of my students, you know, the guys that I mentor, the guys that I coach, these guys got to know that, hey, they're mentor, their sensei can go out there and still do it. Hey, I'm still the boss, and I got to go out there and show these young guys that I'm still the boss. You know, so it's very important for me to do it, but only here at Reality of Wrestling, as well as my son. He's 8 years old, man. He asked me just last week. He goes, Dad, what was it like when you was wrestling? You know, and I pull up some old YouTube, you know, and show him. And he goes, man, you was good. You know what I mean? I wish I could have saw you. You know what I mean? So I say, let me show my son. You know, that dad, you know, can still go out there and hold his own a little bit. So that's important as well.
Hey, man, I always keep saying I got one more question for you. So I'm gonna leave that one as the last one. But you're a guy that I could talk to for days. And I always wanted to get down there in person. But I said, hell, we carry along so much on the telephone as well as we do. So I figured, man, let's just do a Skype so we can finally get a podcast done. But I want to come your way. I'd like to come down to a show and experience that. And I'd love to return the favor as well to ever be on your show if you wanted me. But I'd love to do another podcast and talk about your life. I know you've talked about it so many times and been open and very candid about a lot of things, but I'd like to shoot the shit with you again at a deeper level sometime down the road.
Let's get it done, man. Let's get it done ASAP, man. Like I say, we got a lot to give, man. We got a lot to give. There's so many people out there want to hear, you know, us talk about, you know, what we've done, you know, because we've done it, Steve, at a very, very high level, man. We've entertained so many people for so many years, man. And for us to actually still be here, man, we lost so many soldiers along the way, man. We lost so many carpenters, man. So many guys that could be giving back, you know, and letting these young guys know what it's like to experience what we're going through right now, man, because I love being on this side of the ring, man. It's awesome. I play golf every week, man. You know what I mean? I go out there kicking all my buddies' asses, you know, and having a cold. And so, hey, man, to be able to do what we do, man, is special. So, hey, man, whenever you need me, man, just call me. Let's get it done. Say when.
You got a golf game?
Hey, man, I play, bro. I play, man. That's my thing, man. I got a simulator at home. I've been playing for like 13, 14 years now, trying to get on the, you know, celebrity golf tour, you know. I played in a few pro-ams, whatnot, you know. And I'm bad, man. When I'm like, you know, I call myself Tiger Book Woods on the course.
Dude, I'm coming down to play golf with you, and I ain't worth a shit. But my competitive level, dude, I'm going to give you a run for your money. Booker T, WWE Hall of Famer, it was great talking to you.
Appreciate it, Doc.
Thank you for joining us for another classic episode of The Steve Austin Show. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends. For more Steve Austin Show, go to podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
All month long on Pluto TV, stream the biggest Tyler Perry movies free. Watch your favorites like Madea's Witness Protection and Madea's Big Happy Family. Join Tyler Perry as he goes on a couples retreat with Sharon Leal in Why Did I Get Married? Or Idris Elba and Gabrielle Union in the Tyler Perry-directed film Daddy's Little Girls. Plus, Pluto TV has hundreds of channels with thousands more movies and TV shows, available on live and on demand. Download the free Pluto TV app on all your favorite devices and start streaming now. Pluto TV. Drop in. Watch free.
Hey, Friday Night Lights fans. It's Not Only Football, Friday Night Lights and Beyond is an episode-by-episode discussion of the hit TV series Friday Night Lights, hosted by yours truly, Scott Porter, who played Jason Street on the show, and my two wonderful co-hosts.
Me, Zach Guilford, a.k.a. Matt Saracen.
And me, Mae Whitman, a.k.a.
someone who wasn't on the show but really, really loves it a lot.
We will also bring on some special guests, answer your questions, and tell you about what's going on in our lives today.
It's Not Only Football. Friday Night Lights and Beyond is available now wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
Clear eyes, full hearts, can't lose!
Yo, what's good? It's your boy, Big Brother Jake, a.k.a. Jake Warner.
Love your Roman name.
Check it out. I host a show called The Big Brother Jake Podcast, and I take my talents to the biggest and baddest platform on the planet. That's right, baby. Podcast One. My show is unique as I talk about everything. Life, sports, entertainment, being a single dad juggling several jobs. I'm a hot mess, but it's damn entertaining. Subscribe and review now on Apple Podcasts and listen on Podcast One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop punishing yourself with bland, chalky protein shakes and fuel your fitness with the best protein in the game at GNC. We've got the hottest brands and flavors that legit taste like cookies, your favorite cereal, indulgent desserts, and more. It's on at GNC.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.